everyone who called in, made a donation to keep this radio station on the air. Have a blessed Sunday.
Hello, KBFK listeners. This is Matt Cedillo from La Raza Radio, letting you know that we are moving from 4 p.m. on Fridays to Thursdays at 3 p.m. That is Thursdays, 3 p.m. Tune in every week, Thursday, 3 p.m., to the latest in news, analysis, culture from the best and brightest La Raza has to offer. And as always, give you La Raza.
Good morning, I'm Iona Fife and you're listening to Roots, Music and Beyond here on KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's show, we talk to Gilbert Achecar to get his views of the catastrophic, destructive, and escalating wars in the Middle East from Gaza to Lebanon and now to Syria. Gilbert Achecar has written many books on the region, and we'll ask him to explain what is behind renewed hostilities in Syria, how it relates to Israel's terroristic war on Lebanon, and its continued shocking obliteration and ethnic cleansing of Gaza. We'll also get his take on the collapse of the center and continued rise of the far right worldwide, including France and the U.S. What new dangers does he see for the Middle East with Trump's election, which Netanyahu hoped for and actively helped? Stay tuned for Gilbert Achecar's analysis on all this and more when our program returns in just a moment. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman and very pleased to have Gilbert Achecar with us to get his expansive views on the dreadful, deteriorating and spreading wars in the Middle East from Gaza to Lebanon and now to Syria. Gilbert is probably the best person to try to tie together the Israeli destruction of Gaza, its terroristic war on Lebanon, and now the renewed hostilities in Syria. I'm speaking to Gilbert in London, where he's professor of development studies and international relations at SOAS. That's the University of London. I think it's the School of Oriental and Asian Studies.
Oriental and African Studies.
African Studies. I should have remembered that. Yeah. Thank you. And Gilbert is the author of many books translated into numerous languages. His most recent, published by Haymarket Books here in 2023, is The New Cold War, the U.S., Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine. And before that, he published Morbid Symptoms, Relapse in the Arab Uprising, 2016. Before that, The People Want, a radical exploration of the Arab Uprising, which was reissued in 2022, and many other books. Just look him up. You'll want to read his work. He also writes for Le Monde Diplomatique and other outlets and blogs at Gilbert-Achecar, that's ACHCAR.net/blog. So there I've plugged it. I want to say something just quickly about Of Morbid Symptoms and where that title came from. I just came across it writing while in Mussolini's prisons, Antonio Gramsci called fascism a morbid symptom that appears when the old order is dying, but the new is yet ready to be born. And it just seems so apt at this moment. So today we're going to get Gilbert's assessment of this deteriorating situation in the Middle East and the continued rise of the far right and collapse of the center. I'm going to ask all these questions from the U.S. to Europe and beyond. And we're going to ask also about how Trump 2.0 will pose new dangers and challenges, not just in the U.S., but around the globe. We know, as Gilbert has recently posted, that Trump's victory is a major catastrophe for the peoples of the Middle East, on top of the horror that has already been raining down in Gaza since the Hamas attack of October 7th, 2023. And Netanyahu has eagerly hoped for, and this is something that Gilbert wrote, and did everything he could to help bring about Trump's victory, openly inciting his right-wing U.S. allies and refusing to grant Biden and the Harris campaign the Gaza truce that they had been hoping for in order to provide them with an electoral argument that they desperately needed. So the question is, what awaits us now that Trump's return to the White House is confirmed? There is this move to the far right and to actual, you know, let's call it neo-fascism or 21st century fascism, however we want to characterize it. And you also mentioned, you know, this is the, let's call it the, it's not the end of neoliberalism, but it's the mass feeling of we want to be done with neoliberalism. And that's true around the globe. Yet it remains. There was no real resolution of the crisis of 2008 and 9. And I think to add to that, especially in the United States, there's never been any coming to terms with the pandemic. And the mass death in the U.S., more than a million people died, and it's just been shoved under the rug, except, you know, to discredit wearing masks or vaccinations. And this is a gigantic crisis because who died besides the elderly? It was essential workers. You know, and it has to be dealt with. But our subject, actually, I want to get back to more of that, but there's so much ground to cover, Gilbert, and it seems to be unraveling the most in the Middle East. And it's Syria is right now undergoing renewed hostilities. And it's something that's been coming about just on the heels of what you called not a divine ceasefire in Lebanon. So if Syria is the new theater of war in the Middle East, how do you see that? What's really happening? And how is this tied into, you know, this international deterioration, literally, of the way politics is usually done?
Yeah, well, it's a kind of chain reaction that you have. I mean, and there are several conflicts and they are all interconnected. So Syria, of course, is not new. That's a country that where civil war started 12 years ago in 2012, basically, or the end of 2011. If you haven't heard much about war in Syria over the last few years, it's because you had a stalemate. There was no peace. It was just a kind of stalemate and various forces in control of different parts of the territory. Now, what happened is that the severe blow dealt to Hezbollah in Lebanon created an opportunity for the opponents of the Syrian regime. Here we're speaking of an Islamic fundamentalist group originating actually from Al-Qaeda, but which split a long time ago from Al-Qaeda, which was essentially Syrian, even though they have some foreign fighters with them. And they were based in the northwest of the country, and they had connections with Turkey, which provided the only outlet that they have out of their region. And you had a kind of coexistence between these people controlling this region, the northwest, adjacent to areas directly controlled by the Turkish military and their local allies. The Syrian regime controlled area. But when we say Syrian regime controlled area, we mean Russian and Iranian controlled area, because the Syrian regime alone would not be at all in a position to control some two-thirds of the territory that it controlled until now. So the opportunity was this heavy blow dealt to Hezbollah, given that Hezbollah was the main form of intervention by Iran in Syria. And given that they had been very much weakened by what happened in Lebanon, on a background where the Russian troops and forces in Syria had also been reduced quite significantly due to Ukraine, So this created, therefore, this opportunity that these guys seized, obviously with Turkish backing, and they moved into Aleppo, which the regime, with Russia and Iran behind it, had reconquered in 2016. So these guys pushed there, and they themselves actually were surprised by the rapidity with which the regime's forces collapsed. And this is actually quite similar to what happened in the summer of 2014, when you had Islamic State forces that were, until 2014, essentially in Syria. And in 2014, they crossed the border with Iraq, and they were themselves surprised by the rapidity with which the Iraqi army collapsed, and they managed to invade and conquer a huge stretch of territory. And that led to the international intervention against them, the United States and others. And finally, they were defeated. Now, these guys had the same experience of finding it surprisingly easy for them to conquer Aleppo. The reason, I would say, is similar, because in both Iraq and Syria, where you had sectarian dynamics prevailing, you have soldiers that had no real incentive in defending the territory that is not that of their own sect, right? So in Iraq 2014, it was an attack of the Islamic State in Sunni areas, the Sunni branch of Islam in Iraq. And this time, it's the same. They are attacking also in Sunni majority city. And the troops of the Iraqi regime were overwhelmingly Shia troops, and the troops of the Syrian regime are overwhelmingly Alawite troops, which is a branch of some connections with Shiism. So, I mean, all this is rather difficult to fathom for a Westerner, because you are far from, you know, these kind of sectarian mosaics and all that. But that's the reality of the region. And it's been like this for a very long time. So that's a dynamics that has no progressive dimension in it, unfortunately.
I was just going to ask you to just explain a little more, because it seems like it's almost hard to keep track of which forces Iran, then Russia, are backing, and Turkey as well, because it's conflicting. Yeah. And it seems like you're situating this, and I think I'm probably going to agree with you, like in a geopolitical frame. Mm. And yet, you know, there's no, for people who are trying to figure out, well, are there any good guys here? Are there, you know, what? Yeah. Help us understand a little more.
Yeah, well, you know, I'd start by what a historian friend of mine, he says, if you understood anything, that means the explanation was not good.
Okay, I get that. So, maybe we should
so you see this, what? It's just to say that it's so complex and complicated,
right,
that, of course, it's normal that someone who is not accustomed to all this would find it quite, difficult to understand. But basically, that's also because it's a theater of several wars. It's a theater of local and regional and international hostilities or rivalries are settled in this part of the world. And one key reason fueling all that, and never is the term fueling more adequate than here, because we're speaking of oil. So because this is such a strategic part of the world, it has been for so long a theater of all kinds of global, regional, and local rivalries and fights. And that's what you have. So basically, who are the players? You can go from the two most involved globally are the United States and Russia. These are the two most involved, and those that are involved militarily directly. Then the regional players, of course, you have Israel, you have Iran, you have Turkey, and you have the Gulf monarchies. And even there, there are some major differences between the Gulf monarchies' positions on a number of issues. And then in each country, so these global and regional rivalries fuel local divisions to win over part of the people there. Most commonly, these are the sectarian divisions. So this or that branch of Islam. And then you have the ethnic divisions, Kurds, Arabs, others. And you put all this together, you get this cocktail of extremely complex composition. And that's why it is difficult to understand unless you are really following this very closely. You get the impression that, oh my God, this is a total mess. Well, it is a mess, but there are some there is some logic in this mess, which is the various interests. And then to complicate all that, Susie, the regional players are a specialist in turning completely their positions. So you can Turkey may have this position today to be, for instance, very anti the Syrian regime, and the next day try to reconciliate with it. Iran and the Saudis can be, at very hostile relations, and then they can turn into, or play or give the impression that they have good relations. I mean, that adds a further dimension to the complexity. And it's probably the most complex part of the world, I mean, in that sense, because the number of factors involved and the fact that even those factors can be changing. So all this makes of it really what gives the rest of the world this impression of terrible mess.
Well, it is a mess, and I'm really glad that you're at least adding some little instances of clarity that help us understand how complex it is. You did mention, as you started to, explain it, Gilbert Achkar, that the weakening of Hezbollah is behind a lot of the momentary hostilities. And I think we were all shocked, at least here, to see Israel's terror attack on Hezbollah, there's no other way of describing it, when they simultaneously blew up the cell phones of thousands of people, created thousands of hostilities, and then proceeded almost astonishingly to bombard Lebanon, your own country, and to do so in such a way that it literally was shocking. People thought, okay, the war in Gaza is winding down, and all of a sudden Israel then moves to Lebanon, but at the same time increases, what they're doing in Gaza. And as you say, weakening Hezbollah. And I think, and you wrote a very good piece on your blog, and it also appeared elsewhere, saying that the ceasefire in Lebanon is no divine victory. I don't know precisely why you use those words, but I think what would be in order here for our listeners, Gilbert, is to explain a little bit, I guess, what Hezbollah represents, because you talk a lot about its dual loyalties, yet it is a Lebanese entity? And maybe you can explain a little bit and then tie it in as both Iran's principal force in the region and, of course, Israel's enemy.
Right. The title you're referring to is actually a reference to the phrase that was used by Hezbollah to describe 2006, the previous Israeli onslaught on Lebanon. At the end of it, Hezbollah claimed it as a divine victory, and which also was playing on words, because in Arabic, the name of the general secretary of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, who was assassinated in September, his name in Arabic means God's victory. So to say a divine victory was a kind of play on words, that it is one due to divine support and two due to the leadership of Nasrallah. So that's why I titled that And, you know, I wrote this article before the ceasefire was proclaimed, right before, a few hours before. To be frank, I wasn't expecting Hezbollah to repeat the claim in such a way, because they claimed right after that they had won, which, of course, this time doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense at all. And it's almost, I should say, obscene when you have had such level of destruction, absolutely a huge level of destruction. You've had more than 3,000 people killed, and the organization decapitated because Israel managed to kill most of their leaders, and especially the military ones. And the organization suffering very heavy blows. The destruction of its military infrastructure is quite something. So with such a balance sheet, such a result, to say, oh, we won, doesn't make any sense. And even the global, I mean, the press comment where we're just wondering how can they claim to have won. I mean, in 2006, it made sense to claim victory. And why? Because the Israeli onslaught, already at that time, you had widespread destruction. And some degree of killing, less than this time. Yet Hezbollah, by the end of that war, maintained its force and capacity and was able very quickly to reconstruct its force and even increase it tremendously. Of course, all that through Iran sending weapons to them. So they constituted, after 2006, a much more impressive arsenal than whatever they had before 2006. So having claimed in 2006, victory made sense from that point of view. Today, this will be much more difficult to do because the ceasefire agreement and the resolution, the UN resolution of 2006 that they are supposed to implement this time truly, because last time it wasn't, will be monitored by the United States. Well, Israel, of course, monitors all that, but the United States and France, but the United States will be here in the key role, will be monitoring that, making sure that Hezbollah cannot return to the part of South Lebanon from which it is supposed to withdraw, and also that it doesn't get rearmed by Iran through Syrian territory. All this will be monitored by the United States and Israel. And you have a direct now today involvement of the United States in doing that. And when you think of the fact that the man who negotiated all that for the Biden administration, Amos Hochstein, is, a dual citizen, Israeli-American, and served in the Israeli army. So you get a sense of what we are talking about. So no, definitely Hezbollah has been very much weakened. They will try, of course, to rebuild their power, but the United States and Israel especially will this time be also very closely monitoring everything and really trying to prevent that from happening. And if they manage to do that, the next step for them will be to disarm Hezbollah, which is part of this resolution that was confirmed. For this, you would need a force that has the capacity of doing that. And Washington has been betting over the last years on the Lebanese armed forces, the regular armed forces. Mm. Washington has been funding and arming these armed forces. This will certainly increase now, and Trump will continue on this path along with his in-law, the father of his son-in-law, whom he appointed as representative for the region. You know, nepotism at its best.
Just a clarifying question in a way. We spoke, you know, in 2019 when the mass demonstrations in Lebanon from one side of the country to another was one of the bright spots on the globe in this sort of global anti-austerity, anti-neoliberal demonstration. And it happened, I can't remember exactly before or exactly after that gigantic explosion that literally tore apart the country, and that the regime in power was blamed for neglect and for corruption and for everything else. And, you know, we didn't, at least in popular imagination, hear so much more after that. And then Hezbollah is the one thing that we hear a lot about. And I asked you that because I'd like to get at least a little bit of clarity in terms of what does it represent to have a force like Hezbollah in the country that is not the Lebanese government, but in a way sort of is? Or is it? And what, you know, who's governing? What is the economic situation now when it was such a basket case? Where's that movement? And how does it all fit into what's happening? Because I have to say, in any other scenario, to have that kind of terror attack from Israel on another country would be an outrage and would cause a wider war. Maybe it is causing a sort of wider war, but not the one that one would think. And it just went by without people saying, hey, wait a second, Israel had no right to do this. So maybe you could take it from there. I've asked you a bunch of questions.
Right. Well, in this case, Susie, Israel can say that Hezbollah started the war because objectively speaking, after the Hamas attack on 7 October 2023, the next day, Hezbollah started a kind of war of attrition with Israel, started bombing the Israeli side and Israel retaliating. And this went on from October to September and remained limited by a kind of tacit agreement between Israel and Hezbollah, not bombing beyond a few kilometers each side of the border, basically, trying to limit themselves to that. So this carried on until September. And then in September, when Israel had basically, since the summer, finished most of the job of genocide that it is conducting, this genocidal war that it is conducting in Gaza, Israel turned against Hezbollah. It wasn't possible that Israel would tolerate this kind of intervention and then end it up amicably, if you want. No, I mean, that was clear that for them, I mean, the destruction of Gaza under the pretext of destroying Hamas, but basically here, there, you can't make a distinction between, you know, the population and all that. So they went into a real genocidal war, and Amnesty International today published a very important report on that with a very clear argumentation on why it is definitely, and I think there's hardly any real margin of discussion on that, this is really genocidal. Anyway, Israel, having done most of the job in the summer, decided to now focus on the Lebanese side, except that it attacked in a different manner, which was much more targeted than whatever you had in Gaza. In Gaza, it was just destructions. It's like a bulldozer. And when you look at the satellite images, it's absolutely impressive. And then you get into this situation where you have some 50,000 or more than 50,000 dead, because the official figure is above 45,000, plus you have an estimate of 10,000 under the rebels. So that gets you to 55,000. And if you follow the logic of analysis by the British medical journal, the Lancet, and you conservatively multiply the number of people directly killed by four, which is a conservative figure in comparison with other conflicts, in order to get the number of indirect killings, then what you get over 200,000 people killed. And that's really a genocide. So Israel shifted to Lebanon, and there it used a much more technological war, you know. So you have those pagers. I mean, that was, well, very clever in the art of killing. But they did, I mean, the Mossad did something great with that. And this will be in the books. But, I mean, of course, for murderous purposes. They started with that, and then they carried on. They showed that they had full knowledge about Hezbollah, actually they had very advanced intelligence about Hezbollah, able to monitor every move they do, able to localize their leaders and kill them one after the other, you know. Now, very, very heavily, like they used 80 bombs of 2,000 pounds each. So it's overkill to kill Hassan Nasrallah, you know, but they really wanted not to leave any possibility of survival. And then they started escalating, striking at the military infrastructure of Hezbollah and increasingly striking at the civilian environment, including civilian institutions. For instance, the network of popular banks, you know, microcredit that Hezbollah had organized, they started even striking at that and destroying whole neighborhoods. And that's a doctrine of the Israeli military that was formulated in 2006, which calls openly for disproportionate retaliation that would not focus mainly on the military, but mainly on the civilian environment, kind of to teach a lesson so that you deter them from bothering you, annoying you anytime in the future. And this doctrine, which is in full contradiction with international humanitarian law, it's blatantly contradicting the law of war, the codes of war, the ethical code of war, if you want. Well, this has been applied this time in Lebanon to force Hezbollah into accepting the conditions that Israel wanted. Now, Hezbollah, you asked me, Hezbollah is a state in the state. Mm. It is really a state of its own. It has all the institutions of a state, army, police, intelligence, banks, schools, everything. It is really a state, except that it's a sectarian state. That is, it's basically for the in the Shia community where Hezbollah is rooted, and where Hezbollah is dominant. But there is another Shia organization which is an ally of Hezbollah, but okay, it's at the same time a rival among the Shia. So this state within the Lebanese state, which is a very weak state, as you can deduct from what I'm saying, has been at the same time a pillar of this very rotten, corrupt order that has prevailed in Lebanon since the 90s. And when you had in 2019, the beginning of an uprising on a class, if you want, or on a social issue about the economic situation, protest against the completely corrupt banking system in that country, which is actually responsible for what even the World Bank characterized as one of the major economic crises, collapses in economic history. And in that case, with a degree of plunder, of heist, that is unseen of. I mean, it's a banking system just robbing the population of their belongings, of their deposits. For instance, you, Susie, you had put aside $50,000, and then suddenly they tell you can't use them. And if you want to use them, you have to use the equivalent in the Lebanese currency, even though the actual rate had collapsed. So that means if you want to use your dollars, you'll have to accept to lose more than two-thirds of them in value, or even more. Anyway, so you had an uprising on the economic issue, and it was promising in the sense that it cut across the sects and regions and all that. It was really horizontal, not sectarian as previous dynamics, except that it didn't last. It was soon repressed. On the one hand, Hezbollah played an important role in repressing the movement. Mm. On the other, COVID intervened in 2020. And the sectarian dynamics prevailed again, which is recurrent in Lebanese history. We've had several instances of social movements ending up perverted or through the sectarian dynamics. And that's what happened.
I'm glad you said that because it puts it into a better perspective. And I want to just finish up with your analysis of what Israel's doing in Gaza and in the region. But just to go back, one last question on Lebanon, given how thorough this defeat or weakening of the leadership of Hezbollah means, and you mentioned earlier about arrogance, and I think you were talking about Macron, certainly arrogant. We know that Netanyahu is, and just this idea that he could take on Iran this way, and it seemed that the trajectory was that first Lebanon, then Iran. How do you see that now, and how do you see Lebanon's weak state, as you called it, and weak regime being able to do anything to change the trajectory that we're seeing in movement?
If ever the failed state category made any sense anywhere, it's in Lebanon. That's a country where for now over 2 years you haven't had a president. After the previous one ended his term, they weren't able to elect a new one. It's the parliament there that elects the president. So you have a just caretaker government. So everything is suspended. It's been like this for 2 years in the country. No, I mean, the Lebanese state has traditionally been weak, and in the periods of relative stability, it was a result of a compromise between two foreign dominant powers. And you can name them through history. For instance, in the late 50s, you had the U.S. Marines intervention in Lebanon, 1958, on the background of some kind of civil strife. The outcome was a compromise between Washington and Cairo at the time. Cairo was led by Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the key figure of Arab nationalism, left-wing nationalism. And so you had a modus vivendi, you had a kind of agreement on Lebanon, and that provided for a few years of stability. And then you had the 67 war, the Arab-Israeli war, and Israel's occupation of Arab territories, which destabilized the region. And soon after that, you had a war, which went on for 15 years in Lebanon, from 1975 until 1990, with ups and downs. And various changes in positions. You know what I was telling you at the beginning, Susie, and pardon me if you have a headache after all that, but that's how it is. Like, for instance, the Syrian regime intervened in Lebanon in 1976 to repress the Palestinian resistance, the Palestinian movement, and the Lebanese left. You had an alliance of the Palestinian movement and the Lebanese left. The Syrian regime intervened to repress them, to prevent them from winning, because they were prevailing in the civil war that started the year before, 75. And so you had the Syrian intervention with Israeli and U.S. green light. Okay? A couple of years later, when Israel started the peace treaty, the peace process with Egypt, the Syrian regime reverses its position and started clashing with the Christian right-wing forces that it had rescued in 76, right? And then some years later, you have Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, right, on the background of a collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990 and all that. And then the Syrian regime joins the U.S.-led war on Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, so you see what I'm telling you.
It really is. You know, and I'm so glad.
You have several actors, local, regional, international, and especially the local and regional, they can switch positions. They can change positions radically. I mean, complete turns. So That's why it is. It looks so complicated and difficult to.
It's incredibly complicated, but I wanted to have you on the air today, Gilbert, because I couldn't think of no one who could tie it together, and you're doing so. And in the remaining minutes that we have, you know, I want to make reference to your new book on the new Cold War, but also, you know, we talk a little bit about what Israel's intent seems to be, because as you said, if you look at Gaza, it's as if, you know, a bulldozer has gone through the country and we have a deliberate policy of starvation. And the word genocide has certainly come up a lot. At the beginning of the war in Gaza, I thought genocide wasn't quite the right word because Israel would be just as happy with the new Nakba to clear the region. They didn't care if people were killed or not. I no longer know for sure what I think about that. But I thought, if anything, the real war that to me was of genocidal intent was Russia's war in Ukraine, where they denied the existence of Ukraine and of Ukrainians, and in fact called them Nazis to be denazified. Well, we have these two terrible wars going on that have completely changed the trajectory of the 21st century. And you were talking just a minute ago, Gilbert, about what the collapse of the Soviet Union did in terms of destabilizing the Middle East. And in so many ways, you know, I cheered the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was a major impediment to any development toward what we now call democratic socialism. And I still feel that way. And yet the left has been weak everywhere and has not been able to take any advantage and change the trajectory. In these last, you know, moments, take as long as you need to discuss this trajectory and the bigger picture behind what you think Israel is doing plays into this, and especially in Gaza, now Lebanon, and to some extent elsewhere.
Well, the collapse of the Soviet Union could have opened the gates for what you described or what you hoped. But unfortunately, what you had is Weimar-like conditions created in Russia, post-Soviet Russia. And Weimar is a reference to the condition of Germany after the First World War. And when you had this combination of economic collapse of the 90s in Russia was absolutely terrible, and humiliation, national humiliation in some way. And that was essentially through the expansion of NATO, the Clinton administration's decision to expand NATO into areas that were formerly under Soviet domination. And that's where we got into what I called since 1999 a new Cold War. 1999 because it's the first post-1990 instance of the United States and its allies circumventing completely the Security Council and therefore circumventing Moscow and Beijing as permanent members of the Security Council and launching a war out of the boundaries of international law, the Kosovo War. Mm. And if you remember in 1990, George Bush Sr. had promised a new world order
that used
based
to be
on international law.
The new world disorder. But yes.
Right, exactly. So that's the issue. And that's how we got into this this new Cold War. Now, how to connect that to Israel? I mean, Netanyahu, let's put it that way, has not taken sides between Moscow and Washington, has not... because he needed to keep good relations with Russia, given that Russia is in Syria. And here again, Susie, adding to the headache, Israel regularly bombs Syrian territory. What does Israel bomb on Syrian soil? It bombs Iranian and Hezbollah concentrations. Hezbollah, of course, in Israel's perspective, is just an Iranian proxy, an Iranian tool. Now, you can ask yourself how come that none of those armada, this of air force of Russia that exists in Syria, and all these anti-aircraft missiles, Russian anti-aircraft missiles that are deployed on Syrian territory, are never shot at Israeli planes. Why so? Well, because there is an agreement between Israel and the Russians to allow Israel to freely bomb the Iranians in Syria. You see, that's also part of the crazy condition of this part of the world. For instance, you saw Israel did not condemn the invasion of Ukraine or things like that. And you have even paradoxes like at the beginning of the onslaught on Gaza, Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, saying, well, the Western countries are supporting Israel in doing exactly what we were doing in Ukraine, because we are intervening against Nazi terrorists. And that's what the Israelis are doing in Gaza. We are laughing at all that, but really it's not laughing matter. It's more tragic than anything, and especially Gaza. It's absolutely horrendous. I describe this as the first genocide perpetrated by an industrially advanced country since 1945, and with the full support of the West and the full participation of the United States, because this war on Gaza is the first joint U.S.-Israeli war ever. If you take all the wars of Israel, 48, the United States was embargoing the weapons for the whole region. Actually, the Zionist movement got weapons more from the Soviet Union through Czechoslovakia than from the United States.
Right.
56, the war of Israel and France and Britain on Egypt, United States stood against it and voted for it to stop. And that's what was a key factor, this Moscow-Washington convergence on stopping that war. 67, well, the United States was very happy with it because it dealt heavy blows to Egypt and Syria, which at that time were led by a regime that were relatively progressive and leftist compared to what you have today. But the Israeli weapons were German and French. The countries that had mostly helped Israel during the first 20 years were Germany, Western Germany, and Israel, not the United States. So that changed in the late 60s. But then 73, you had a war supported by the United States, but when it started turning into a counteroffensive by Israel, the United States pulled the brake and forced Israel to stop. Then you have the wars on Lebanon. None of them were supported by the United States. At least not officially and not practically directly. So this is the first war which is fully armed, funded, and politically endorsed completely by the United States to the point of opposing any calls for a ceasefire during several months. And until recently, you know, you remember recently the United States was alone against 14 members of the US United Nations Security Council in voting against, again, a new resolution on ceasefire. So this is really a US-Israeli joint war, the first one. And it happens to be a genocidal war that is condoned by the Western system at the very same time when this Western system is applying a completely different standard in Ukraine. And this double standard, which has become so obvious, and especially for the global South, means that the whole credibility of the so-called liberal rules-based order, blah, 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 and this whole a kind of ideological architecture of the Atlantic Alliance, what gave NATO and all that, all this has been completely discredited. And that's a major shift in global history when you combine it with the rise of the far right and the return to power of a Donald Trump, for whom there is no rules-based international order. He doesn't give a damn about any rules.
Well, this is
America
exactly
first.
If I could just interject, and this will be really the last thing we're running over time, but it's just so, if anything, certainly Biden helped lose the election for Harris. That wasn't the only reason. The Democrats ran a terrible campaign, but and there was a lot of other features. But even Harris herself last year made a very good statement about ceasefire. And then once she became the candidate, she moderated it. And she talked about, well, Israel has the right to defend itself, all of these things. And then you get now the, release of statements that Biden is, hates Netanyahu and feels stabbed in the back and yet supports. And so the real issue here is you just started to go into, and we really need to finish it, about the effect of Trump, who doesn't care. How do you see the rationale? What is the driving force here to create this kind of, level of destruction, discrediting of regimes? The West can no longer pretend to be the beacon of democracy when it supports this outright starvation and destruction of an entire population, and even, leaking plans to create beachfront properties in Gaza. It's all cynical, but heartbreaking, and also needs to be thought. So maybe I can get your last sort of sentiments on all of that.
You mean for the United States? Because, yes, the question is often posed that why on earth is the United States supporting such a thing without even putting any limitations to it, when it is so obviously harmful to U.S. interests, right? And in this case, really, I think you have a personal factor, because the United States foreign policy is so centralized. I mean, C. Wright Mills already said that in such a system of concentration of power, the person at the helm can influence a lot the direction of things. And Joe Biden is the first ever U.S. president to claim from the White House and repeatedly that he is a Zionist.
Yeah.
Had you had Barack Obama instead of Biden, you can bet on the fact that you wouldn't have had the same unconditional, total support for the Israeli state. You would have had some limitation put to it. And also the relations between Obama and Netanyahu were very bad. I mean, they hated each other. And Netanyahu played the Republicans all the time against Obama. When Biden campaigned in 2020, he promised to reverse what Donald Trump had done. During his term, Donald Trump went further than any U.S. president in granting Israel what Israel wanted, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, closing the U.S. consulate in Arab Jerusalem, acknowledging the annexation of the Syrian Golan Heights. So really, Donald Trump just forgot about the so-called bipartisan consensus on the Israeli issue, and went much further than that. Now, Biden had promised to reverse that, except that when he came to power, when he got to the White House, instead of reversing Trump's policies and going back to the kind of Obama kind of thing, he actually continued Trump. He continued with Trump and went even further than Trump. On two issues, Biden has been the continuation of Trump. I'm speaking in foreign policy, the Middle East and China. On these two issues, and the explanation you get here is the lack of vision about U.S. interest in the region, because all this is creating a huge time bomb. And you will see, I mean, this genocide won't have less repercussions historically than the Nakba, even in 1948, the creation of the State of Israel. And this will lead to more turmoil in an already fragmented and very, very explosive region. And of course, whatever you get there doesn't stop there. It spills over into the global north, into Europe, because it's the nearest, but also into the United States.
Well, I thank you for all of that. There's much more that I want to talk to you about it, but we've run out of time today. And I guess in one sense, it's also cynical too, especially on the part of both Trump and Netanyahu, who have their own personal interests in being in power that has nothing to do with the effect that they have with their power. It's to stay out of jail. In any case, that's another discussion. But I want to thank you so much, Gilbert Achecard, and tell people to go out and get your newest book, which is The New Cold War, the U.S., Russia, and China from Kosovo to Ukraine, but also your other books about the Arab uprising, morbid symptoms that people want, even Clash of Barbarisms, all of them help us so
thank
much.
Thank you, Susie. May I point to my next book coming out in the summer, which is called Gaza, A Genocide Foretold. And it will come out of University of California Press.
That we will talk about as soon as it comes out. And I want to thank you for everything, Gilbert. It's been a great pleasure, Gilbert Achecard.
Thank you, Susie. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Hello, everyone. This is Susie Wiseman, and I'm here to ask for your support and your sponsorship of this program, Beneath the Surface, and this station, KPFK. We're here during the fund drive, and this is the time when we ask you listeners to support the radio station. And I should say sponsor it because it's a listener-sponsored radio station. And if you value the kind of programming that I've been bringing to you for more than 40 years, I'm going to ask you to please put your money where your ears are and go to your phones and call up at 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK or go online to www.kpfk.org and pledge your support. It costs money to keep free speech radio on the air. We don't have commercials. It's not a commercial station. And we don't sell your data anywhere, but we do ask you way too much, in fact, to cough up support for the radio station. And I'm asking you to do that now. And I'm joined by Alan Minsky. He is no stranger to our airwaves. He spent many years as our program director, and he is now the executive director of Progressive Democrats for America. And it's a really important message that we bring you. KPFK and part of the Pacifica Foundation. So we're going to ask you to call in at 818-985-5735 and support this radio station and specifically this program, Beneath the Surface. And I'm going to let Alan talk to you for just a second. But I want to say that this is not just something I'm doing as a day job. Take it seriously. Do a lot of preparation and try to bring you the most information I can in a way that you can understand it. Because I, you know, firmly believe that we can't be effective participants in our society unless we're armed with information. Now, there's lots of places to get information, but there's not that many places to get the kind of analysis that I try to bring each week. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Please call in and support this radio station. Let's try to make it better, and let's try to keep it on the air for the next millennium. That's a long time in the future. But Alan, let's hear from you.
Oh, well, just I hope people right now just pick up the phone and call 818-985-5735. They can go to kpfk.org, make a donation, maybe, you know, make a note that it's for Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. I have learned so much from this show. I can't believe the wealth of insight, knowledge, and historical background, and just everything that makes that provides a strong foundation for intellectual understanding of the present I have received from Beneath the Surface. And getting to work with Susie on the show has been an incredible privilege for me. And again, I really do think for me working on it, and for you, the listeners, getting to hear it, this is as good information as you can get to understand the world we live in any university graduate course anywhere in the world. Incredible, incredible insight on this show. All of it placed inside the framework of the history that we're all living in this globalized world. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Call now. Please, please, please support Beneath the Surface.
And thank you so much, Alan Minsky. And I'm Susie Wiseman. Remember, support the station and call in your pledge. 818-985-5735 or kpfk.org. Thanks so much. And that's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Gilbert Achecard. Thanks also to executive producer Robert Brenner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gotha, and Gary Baca in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows, as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. More information on programs and guests are on our Facebook page, and that's Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at KPFK. Thanks for listening. I'm Susie Wiseman.
KPFK.org or call 818-